This is Jude Costello, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is The Week magazine. Israel plans retaliation after massive Iranian attack. From The Week magazine. The decades-long shadow war between Israel and Iran moved closer to open conflict this week after Tehran launched an unprecedented aerial assault on the Jewish state and Israel pledged to strike back. Iran aimed more than 300 drones and missiles at Israel in a coordinated five-hour attack. Tehran said the barrage was in response to an Israeli strike on an Iranian diplomatic compound in Syria that killed two senior Iranian military commanders. Most of the Iranian weapons were intercepted before reaching Israeli airspace with the help of the U.S., U.K., and Jordan. Israel's air defenses destroyed almost all of the rest. The sole casualty was an Israeli Bedouin girl wounded by falling debris. In a phone call with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, President Biden urged restraint over fears a counterstrike could spark a wider Middle East conflagration. "You get a win, take the win," Biden reportedly said, adding that the U.S. would not take part in offensive action against Iran. Netanyahu later told Western diplomats that Israel would do everything necessary to defend itself and that we will make our own decisions. Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi warned that the slightest retaliation by Israel would be dealt with fiercely and severely. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said the U.S. was preparing new sanctions targeting Iran's missile and drone program, while British Foreign Secretary David Cameron urged other G7 nations to coordinate sanctions against Iran and show a united front. House Speaker Mike Johnson advanced a stalled foreign aid package for Israel, Ukraine, and other allies in defiance of threats to his job from hard-right Republicans. Split into five parts, the package mirrors a $95 billion aid bill that was passed by the Senate in February and opposed by many conservatives who argue the U.S. border should be secure before funding is sent to Ukraine. GOP Representatives Marjorie Taylor Greene and Thomas Massie pledged to push for Johnson's ouster as Speaker if he sought aid for Kyiv. Biden said he'll swiftly sign the package into law if it's passed, which would require Democrats to line up behind the aid deal. "We stand with our friends," the president said, "and we won't let Iran or Russia succeed." Iran's attack was a powerful reminder that the Tehran regime remains the biggest threat to peace in the Middle East, said Bloomberg. As the risk of a wider war snowballs, Israel's best path forward is resolve and restraint rather than military escalation. A retaliatory strike would cast Israel once again as the aggressor, jeopardizing international alliances that have already been strained by the war in Gaza. Israel's long-term security requires peaceful relations with its neighbors, including Palestinians, and containment of Iran. And the best way there is not lobbing missiles, but rigorous and assertive diplomacy. For the Biden administration to stand in the way of Israeli retaliation would be morally disgraceful and strategically inane, said National Review. Iran has repeatedly attacked Israel through its Hamas and Hezbollah proxies, and we can't just hope that its next aerial assault will be unsuccessful. No nation can live under such a threat, and if Iran is further emboldened, it will invite the very regional conflict Biden is desperate to avoid. "A devastating response is required, and Israel must have our unwavering support." Iran's aerial barrage was an impressive and terrifying sight, said Jason Rezaian in The Washington Post. But it sent a message of weakness, not strength. It was thwarted with apparent ease and struck not a single meaningful target. Either Tehran, which took pains to telegraph the attack, pulled its punches, or it tried to land a body blow and failed. Either way, it signals that Iran, its economy crippled by sanctions, is in no position to fight a direct, protracted war. Those downplaying the attack as a symbolic show of force are denying reality, said Frieda Gittes in CNN.com. With a miraculous display of military technology, Israel got lucky this time. But it's impossible to overstate just how cataclysmic Iran's attack could have been and what could have been unleashed. The sight of intercepted missiles exploding above the Temple Mount and other holy sites drives home the potential danger. And what if those missiles and drones had carried nuclear material? The most urgently needed action right now is not in the Middle East, but in Washington, said David Frum in The Atlantic. In their bid to block desperately needed aid for Ukraine, MAGA Republicans have also repeatedly thwarted Biden's effort to help Israel bear the immense costs of its self-defensive war in Gaza. Israel's dazzling air defense comes with a high price tag, and Johnson must find a way to push through assistance that's delayed too long. What next? Israel faces a quandary, said David Ignatius in the Washington Post. Despite pleas from Biden and other world leaders, Israeli officials have resolved that to deter further aggression, they must retaliate. But as they weigh their choices, they're wondering how to send a hard-nosed message without escalating the crisis and risking all-out war. Israel has a range of options, said Jack Desch in Foreign Policy. The most aggressive and risky would be a strike aimed at Iran's nuclear program. A step down would be an attack on another high-value target on Iranian soil, which might include military sites, weapons depots, a top military leader, or even the headquarters of the elite Revolutionary Guard. Among the less provocative options are targeted strikes against military commanders or Iran-backed militias outside Iran, or a cyber attack outside Tehran that would inflict humiliation without bloodshed. Israel likely has to respond, said Jonathan Lord of the Center for a New American Security, but they don't need to rush. In historic first, Trump goes on trial in hush money case. The first ever criminal trial of a former U.S. president began jury selection in a Manhattan courtroom this week, with Donald Trump calling the charges that he falsified records to cover up a hush money payment, political persecution, and election interference. The trial centers on a 2016 payment of $130,000 made by Trump fixer Michael Cohen to porn star Stormy Daniels, which prosecutors say was intended to cover up her 2006 sexual encounter with Trump. Asked whether they could be impartial about the former president, many prospective jurors said they could not and were released. Others were struck from the jury pool for their past social media posts, including one man who had posted, "Lock him up." While Trump appeared to doze off during the proceedings several times, he took interest in the juror questioning at one point, grumbling and gesturing at one woman. That prompted a rebuke from Judge Juan Merchan, who said sharply, "I will not have any jurors intimidated." Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg filed a motion to hold Trump in contempt of court, saying he had violated a gag order against commenting on trial participants in a Truth Social post, calling Daniels and Cohen two sleazebags, and in earlier posts attacking Merchan's daughter, a Democratic consultant. Outside the courtroom, Trump said that the trial schedule would interfere with his presidential campaigning. "This is a persecution like never before," he said, "a case that should never have been brought." After the proceedings one day this week, he stopped at a Harlem bodega that had been robbed in 2022. "Bragg and his staff aren't going after robbers and murderers," he said there. "They go after Trump." Never before has a former and possible future president been a criminal defendant, said the New York Times. It's a momentous occasion, and the proceedings are already demonstrating the great care and respect exercised by every participant except Trump. Mershon has given Trump's lawyers extra time to review records and has excluded evidence that could bias jurors, such as the sexual assault allegations against him. That doesn't sound like the unfair and politically motivated prosecution Trump insists is happening. Don't pretend politics aren't involved, said the Wall Street Journal. Paying hush money isn't a crime. Bragg's complaint is about the paperwork. His reasoning for the 34 felony charges is a legal stretch, which explains why neither federal prosecutors nor his predecessor as DA brought charges. Now the case is being tried in Manhattan, where Trump received barely 12% of the 2020 vote and where jurors are unlikely to favor him. This trial is making history, all right, but in the worst way. Let's stop calling this a hush money case, said Norman Eisen in CNN.com. The issue isn't the payments themselves, but why Trump made them. Bragg's team intends to prove that Trump falsified financial documents by calling his reimbursement of Cohen legal fees because he wanted to unlawfully influence the election. That violates campaign finance laws. Further, Trump and Cohen, the prosecution contends, began buying salacious stories and then burying them in order to deprive voters of information that could have influenced their choice. That's election interference. It's still the shakiest case against Trump, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post. There could be potential federal crimes here, but Bragg employed creative reasoning to claim jurisdiction. And Cohen, a convicted criminal and serial perjurer, will be a defense lawyer's dream. A single skeptic could hang the jury, and if Trump gets off, it would further fuel his claims that every charge against him, even those involving the plot to overturn the 2020 election, is a fabrication by partisan Democrats. Whatever the outcome, this trial will matter, said Noah Rothman in National Review. Prison time is highly unlikely, but the election could be at stake. While polling suggests many voters agree with Trump's contention that he's being persecuted, a majority say they're unwilling to vote for him if convicted. Trump has embraced the role of martyr, said Timothy L. O'Brien in Bloomberg, telling supporters at a rally last week that the trial was a sham, but he was proud to do it for you. But the reality is, he's on trial because he may have committed a crime, and he's being held accountable. It wasn't all bad. In 1978, a science teacher named Patrick Moriarty promised his first group of students that he would organize an eclipse viewing party for the next one to pass near their hometown of Rochester, New York. This month, the 68-year-old teacher delivered on that promise as 100 of his former students watched the eclipse from Moriarty's driveway. Moriarty had contacted them through a Facebook group he created 2 years ago to track down 1,000-plus students he'd taught. After the event, Moriarty suggested the group could meet in 2 decades for the eclipse. "I had an impact on these kids," Moriarty said. Abortion. Can the GOP still call itself a pro-life party? A great GOP abortion retreat has begun, said Lori Roberts in the Arizona Republic. When Arizona's Supreme Court last week resurrected the state's 1864 near-total abortion ban, it extended a stunning legal winning streak for the pro-life movement, one that began with the U.S. Supreme Court's repeal of Roe v. Wade in 2022. Yet rather than celebrate, many Republicans are now backpedaling as if their political lives depend on it, among them U.S. Arizona Senator candidate Carrie Lake. 2 years ago, Lake was hailing the 1864 ban as a great law. But following its revival, she swiftly began lobbying for its repeal and the reinstatement of a 15-week ban to give women more choices. Lake didn't freelance her reversal, said Shelby Talcott in Semaphore. Like Senator Rick Scott, Republican of Florida, who now supports relaxing his state's 6-week ban, Lake is following former President Donald Trump. The man who once bragged of being the most pro-life president in American history last week openly declared abortion a political liability for the GOP. To the dismay of some anti-abortion leaders, he announced his opposition to a federal abortion ban, saying the issue should be left to the states, and urged voters in pro-choice terms to do what's right for your family and do what's right for yourself. Pro-lifers should grab the lifeline thrown by Trump, said Daniel McCarthy in the New York Post. Voters have backed legal abortion access in every ballot referendum since Roe was tossed, even in red states like Kansas and Ohio. And a new Arizona poll shows that last week's court ruling was enough to push Lake's Senate race from toss-up to leans Democratic. If this pattern holds, President Biden will win the swing state and re-election in November, and pro-choicers will push for a federal law guaranteeing legal abortion, undoing 50 years of pro-life gains. Protecting the unborn means winning elections, said Dan McLaughlin in National Review. Unless pro-lifers embrace realism with more moderate positions, at the very least allowing abortion in cases of rape or incest, they could lose the whole ballgame. Good luck with that, said Max Burns in The Hill. Republicans have spent decades stacking the judiciary with anti-abortion extremists who now hold a majority in the U.S. Supreme Court. Voters want revenge for that historic overreach into women's private lives and won't be mollified by panicked reversals from MAGA types. Trump will always do what's best for Trump, said Ramesh Ponuru in The Washington Post. But pro-lifers should stiffen their spines and keep speaking up for the unborn. If Republicans become evasive on abortion, they'll forfeit the issue to Democrats while feeding suspicions that they have an agenda they are not willing to share with voters. Those suspicions are correct, said Susan Rinkunas in Jezebel. While GOP politicians are gaslighting voters with newly moderate positions, far-right lawyers are quietly finalizing plans to use the 1873 Comstock Act, which prohibits sending abortion drugs or devices through the mail, to effectively ban abortion nationwide in a second Trump term. Perhaps, said David French in the New York Times, but incalculable damage to the pro-life cause has already been done. Republicans' willingness to moderate their views for electoral gain suggests they never really believed every unborn child is a human life worthy of protection. Those of us who sincerely hold that belief must face the fact that whoever wins in November, there is no longer a truly pro-life party in the United States. Only in America. A white supremacist who beat up a journalist has been freed from jail because the sentencing judge thinks prosecutors are soft on Antifa. Tyler Laub of California pleaded guilty, and prosecutors requested a six-month sentence. But U.S. District Court Judge Cormac Carney sentenced Laub to time served, 35 days, saying anything more would increase the disparity between Laub's punishment and far-left groups who have committed the same violent conduct. A California state lawmaker wants to ban companies from contacting their employees outside working hours. The Right to Disconnect bill from Democrat Matt Haney would make firms set start and end points to the workday and pay fines if they repeatedly email, text, or call staff during non-working hours. Haney says his goal is for Californians to sit down to dinner without being worried about their phones. It was a good week for snowflakes after toy giant Mattel unveiled Scrabble Together, a collaborative version of the classic spelling game. Mattel said it hopes Scrabble Together, in which players work toward shared goals, will appeal to those who find word games intimidating. It was a good week for kids these days after Poland banned mandatory homework for grades 1 through 8. I am happy, said Ola Kozak, 11, of Warsaw. Ola said many of her classmates copied their answers off the internet anyway, so homework didn't make sense as an educational tool. It was a good week for American carnage after Donald Trump declared during a campaign speech in Schnecksville, Pennsylvania, that the Battle of Gettysburg, in which more than 50,000 Union and Confederate troops were killed or wounded, was so beautiful in so many different ways. It was a bad week for progress after Nike's new uniforms for the U.S. Women's Olympic track and field team were criticized for their skimpiness. Athletes should be able to compete without dedicating brain space to constant pube vigilance, said 5,000-meter champion Lauren Fleshman. It was a bad week for quiet concentration after Fox News devoted a segment to the claim, and all but ignored by mainstream media, that public libraries are turning into drug-infested sex dens. Host Jesse Waters informed viewers that libraries are no longer safe in Joe Biden's America. It was a bad week for campaign finance after FEC filings revealed that disgraced former Representative George Santos has raised precisely $0 in his bid to return to the House. Santos said he has raised no money on purpose as a rebuke to critics speculating that I'm only running to grift. Santa Fe, Russian roulette. The armorer who worked on the Rust set in 2021 when a loaded prop gun killed the film's cinematographer received a maximum prison sentence this week. Judge Mary Marlowe Summer sentenced Hannah Gutierrez Reed, 27, to 18 months in prison for involuntary manslaughter, saying she lacked a sense of guilt. In the trial, a 12-person jury deliberated whether Gutierrez Reed showed willful disregard for the safety of others when she gave Alec Baldwin a gun loaded with live ammunition, which discharged and killed filmmaker Halina Hutchins. Baldwin is also charged separately with involuntary manslaughter. Gutierrez Reed denied bringing live bullets to the set, but police found several on set. From jail, Gutierrez Reed said she didn't need to be shaking the prop guns to ensure the bullets were inert. Every time a gun was loaded with dummy rounds, it was a game of Russian roulette, said prosecutor Carrie Morrissey. Los Angeles, betting scandal. The longtime interpreter of baseball star Shohei Ohtani surrendered to federal authorities last week, facing charges of bank fraud for making unauthorized transfers from Ohtani's account. Ipe Mizuhara allegedly stole $16 million from the 29-year-old L.A. Dodgers star, known for excelling at both pitching and hitting, to fuel a voracious appetite for illegal sports betting, officials said. He racked up $40 million in losses across more than 19,000 bets. Prosecutors allege Mizuhara impersonated Ohtani and made numerous bank transfers from the player's account between November 2021 and January 2024. He faces up to 30 years in prison if convicted. Ohtani denied any knowledge of Mizuhara's actions and has cooperated with investigators. He said Mizuhara's surrender marks a break from the saga and that he wanted to focus on baseball. Mizuhara was freed on a $25,000 bond with a warning from the judge to stay away from gambling. New Jersey, marital discord. A court filing unsealed this week revealed that Senator Bob Menendez, Democrat, New Jersey, may be planning to blame his wife in his federal corruption trial slated to start next month in a New York federal court. In September, Menendez and his wife of 4 years, Nadine Menendez, pleaded not guilty to accepting hundreds of thousands of dollars in bribes from New Jersey businessmen in exchange for favors, including interfering with criminal investigations the businessmen faced and helping the governments of Egypt and Qatar secure business deals. The senator's defense plan, according to his attorney's filing, indicates he will implicate his wife and testify that she withheld information to make him believe nothing unlawful was taking place. Nadine Menendez faces charges in a separate trial. According to her indictment, she was the go-between for the businessman and her husband and received a Mercedes-Benz in her name. Washington, D.C., no trial. The Senate this week dismissed two impeachment counts against Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, with Democrats voting to cut the trial short on a party-line vote. House Republicans passed the impeachment articles in February, charging that Mayorkas refused to comply with the law by refusing to detain undocumented immigrants and that he breached public trust by testifying that the government has control over the border. The charges were delivered to the Senate this week, making Mayorkas only the second cabinet secretary in history to be impeached. Majority Leader Chuck Schumer called the impeachment an illegitimate and profane abuse of the Constitution. Senate Republicans knew that they did not have the two-thirds vote in the Senate to convict Mayorkas, but had hoped to stage a trial that would air the charges. All 100 senators were sworn in as jurors. Democrats, however, dispensed with a full proceeding, quickly rejecting the charges as failing to amount to impeachable crimes. Port-au-Prince, new government of sorts. Haiti announced the formation of a new leadership council last week in an effort to take back the country from the gangs that have controlled the capital since February. The 9-member interim council includes representatives from the main parties and civic groups, including former central bank governor Fritz Alphonse Jean and former Senate President Edgard LeBlanc. Its mission is to implement a U.S.-backed plan to send in Kenyan peacekeepers and appoint a new prime minister. The old one, Ariel Henry, resigned after gangs took over the airport, preventing him from returning to the country. But so far, the council's power is only theoretical. Gang leader Jimmy Barbecue Cherissier threatened to kill its members, describing the council as an illegitimate foreign-backed power grab. Cut off their heads and burn down their houses, he told the followers, echoing a 19th-century Haitian revolutionary slogan. Buenos Aires. Crackdown on protest. A months-long standoff between Argentine authorities and anti-government demonstrators escalated last week when riot police in Buenos Aires used water cannons to disperse crowds blocking a downtown thoroughfare. Demonstrators had gathered outside the Ministry of Human Capital on the 16-lane 9 de Julio Avenue to protest proposed funding cuts to the agency, which runs food pantries nationwide. Argentina's economy has been in crisis for years, and half the country is now in poverty, but President Javier Milei, a self-proclaimed anarcho-capitalist, says the government must take extreme spending cuts. Union leader Juan Carlos Alderete called the crackdown on protesters savage government repression of those who only demand food for community kitchens. Kharkiv, Ukraine. Where's our U.S. defense? Ukrainians reacted with bitterness this week after witnessing the U.S. and other countries leap to protect Israel from incoming Iranian missiles and drones, while failing for months to help Ukraine weather Russian attacks. The whole world sees what real defense is, said President Volodymyr Zelensky. It sees it is feasible. The U.S. and Europe have given Ukraine several advanced air defense systems, but they aren't enough to protect all major cities from near-constant bombardment. In March alone, Zelensky said, Russia lobbed 400 missiles, 600 drones, and 3,000 aerial bombs at Ukraine. Since then, it has pounded Kharkiv and other cities and destroyed power plants around the country. When rockets fly in Israel, the whole world writes about it, Kharkiv resident Amil Nasarov told the New York Times. Here, rockets are flying, and we don't have American bombers that are saving the sky like over Israel. Dubai, United Arab Emirates. Rain bomb. The desert nation of United Arab Emirates was underwater this week after record-shattering rain that dumped more than 2 years' worth of precipitation in just one day. Some parts of the country got an unprecedented 10 inches. The rain bomb hit with such force that it uprooted palm trees and shattered glass storefronts, and so quickly that motorists had to leap out of their vehicles as streets turned into rivers. The scene and the road was surreal, said Deepak Mohan, resident, told the Khalil Times. The water kept rising, even submerging the logo on the hood of the car. Dubai's airport, the second busiest in the world, canceled dozens of flights. Experts said the storm was worsened by climate change, which fuels extreme rainfall because the warmer atmosphere holds more moisture. Sydney, stabbing sprees. Australians were in shock this week after two mass stabbings in Sydney in a matter of days. In the first, a deadly attack, a knife-wielding man killed six people at a shopping mall, five of them women and one a male security guard. A lone police officer on the scene, Amy Scott, pursued the attacker, Joel Couchy, 40, through the mall. When he lunged at her with the knife, she shot him dead. More than a dozen other women were stabbed but survived, and police said that they were investigating whether Couchy was specifically targeting women. His father said Couchy had long had mental illness, had been homeless, and was frustrated that he didn't have a girlfriend. One of the victims was a mother whose 9-month-old baby was also stabbed. The baby is recovering. Just days later, in what authorities are calling a terrorist attack, a Muslim teenager stabbed and wounded an Assyrian Orthodox bishop during a live-streamed church service in suburban Sydney. Video shows a man dressed in dark clothing approaching and striking the bishop as worshippers scream and try to intervene. Five people were injured, including the attacker, 16, whose finger was cut off, apparently on the scene by incensed parishioners. Police arrested the teen at the scene and held him there for his own safety as an angry crowd of the bishop's followers threw rocks and bottles outside for hours. Police Minister Yasmin Catley said authorities would go through all of this youth's life with a fine-tooth comb for evidence of radicalization. Police arrested one other suspect, a 19-year-old man, 2 days later. Hal Wilson shifted her shape. Rebel Wilson made a name for herself in Hollywood by playing the funny fat girl, said Megan Agnew in the Sunday Times, UK. Arriving from Sydney in 2009, the actress says she knew she wouldn't be taken seriously like fellow Australians Kate Blanchett and Nicole Kidman. But I quickly realized that the bigger you were, the more audiences laughed. So I'd have my gut hanging out and wear micro shorts on stage, no makeup. It was part of my plan. It worked, and she quickly began landing seven-figure roles in comedies. People applauded me for being the size I was, telling me I was brave. Soon she was contractually obligated not to let her weight fluctuate by more than 10 pounds. But a few years ago, Wilson realized she had to get healthier. Now she has a leaner but still curvy and solid body. She is comfortable with this physique but didn't receive much encouragement to get to it. Basically, no one apart from my mom wanted me to lose weight. People thought I'd lose my pigeonhole in my career. She also, she admits, had to overcome her own anxieties about stuffing my face as a substitute for dealing with my emotions properly, and worries over whether her success was dependent on her weight. I knew how to be fat. It's who I was. Richson's harrowing modeling days. Alan Richson was traumatized by the modeling industry, said Chris Gardner in The Hollywood Reporter. After dropping out of college, the 6-foot 240-pound Reacher star was working at a Florida gas station when a customer suggested he cash in on his good looks. Moving to Miami at 19, Richson signed with a modeling agency, appearing in Abercrombie and Fitch ads, and traveled the world. But he has little good to say about the business. "It's like legalized sex trafficking," said Richson, 41. "The number of times I was put in horrific environments where sexual abuse was the goal and the paycheck you were desperate for to survive was the carrot. I can't count on two hands. Gigs like the JCPenney catalog were a respite. It was like, thank God, because nobody was trying to get you naked and oiled up in the back of a hotel room." He reached his limit after a shoot with a very famous photographer who sexually assaulted him. "I left and drove straight to the agency. I said, F you for sending me there. You knew what was going to happen and you did it anyway. It was the last photo shoot I've ever had." In 2018, the New York Times ran a story where many male models spoke of similar abuse. "Their tales were my own," said Richson. "It's all true." Just 3 months after tying the knot, Golden Bachelor stars Jerry Turner and Teresa Nist are getting a divorce. Breaking the news on ABC's Good Morning America last week, the senior sweethearts said they decided to split after failing to agree on a place to lay down roots together. Turner, 72, lives in Indiana, while Nist, 70, is in New Jersey. "We looked at home after home," Nist said, "but we never got to the point where we made that decision." The couple, both widowed, had seemingly relished a second chance at finding romance in the Bachelor spinoff. "I know I've found a partner to share all of life's experiences," Turner said during their televised wedding ceremony in January. Bachelor fans were stunned that the marriage was so short-lived. "I still have milk in the fridge from when this was on," one posted on Instagram. A casting agency that supplied extras for Tulsa King has quit the production over allegations that its background actors were repeatedly insulted by star Sylvester Stallone, Deadline reported last week. Extras on the Paramount Plus series flooded a private Facebook group with complaints about Stallone, 77, and an unnamed director claiming the pair loudly mocked some of them on set as ugly, a tub of lard, and a fat guy with cane. The extras said Stallone, who plays an exiled mafia boss in Oklahoma, requested pretty young girls to replace them. Instead, the Rose Lock casting agency pulled out of the show. Director Craig Zisk denied all allegations against Stallone, but said Rose Lock miscast older actors for a hip bar scene that required extras in their 20s and 30s. Electronic musician Grimes had a meltdown while performing to thousands of festival goers last week. Partway through her DJ set at California's Coachella, Grimes, a proponent of utilizing artificial intelligence in music production and the mother of three of Elon Musk's children, began shrieking and screaming into her microphone, befuddled by an apparent equipment malfunction. "All my tracks are twice as fast, so I'm not mixing very well," she told the audience. "It's not my fault." Fans circulated videos of the glitch-filled show on the Musk-owned X. "It's hilarious that maybe the most vocal defender of AI in music is Grimes," one wrote. "And her Coachella set is just a total technical breakdown." Grimes later apologized to fans for her sonic chaos. Bird flu's evolving threat. How dangerous is bird flu? The H5N1 strain circulating around the world is, for birds and other animals, the deadliest avian flu outbreak on record. First detected in China in 1996, it has ripped its way around the world, killing hundreds of millions of domestic and wild birds. More than 90% of chickens infected with H5N1 die within 48 hours. By the time the virus showed up in North America in 2021, It had evolved to become even more contagious. A highly pathogenic variant has now been detected on every continent apart from Australia and in more than 100 different bird species, including migratory waterfowl that keep the virus circulating. The culling of more than 85 million captive birds in the U.S. over the past 2 years has failed to halt the spread, with the disease now showing up in numerous mammal species, including cows. Earlier this month, a Texas dairy worker who had close contact with sick cattle tested positive for H5N1, becoming the first person to have contracted it from a mammal, raising fears the virus could spark a human pandemic. The Centers for Disease Control says H5N1 currently poses a low threat to people because it cannot spread efficiently among humans. But that risk level, said epidemiologist Michael Osterholm, could change in a heartbeat with additional mutations. Is the disease widespread in mammals? It's been detected in nearly 50 species, including mountain lions, bobcats, and polar bears. The virus also has caused mass die-offs among seals, sea lions, and farmed mink. And since March, it has been found in cattle in more than half a dozen states. So far, the variant has been spotted only in dairy cattle, not those raised for beef, and appears to cause only mild illness. Infected cows lose their appetite, and what little milk they produce is thick and discolored. The animals then seem to recover. The cattle may have initially caught the bug from exposure to wild bird droppings or from contaminated feed. The FDA allows ground-up chicken feces to be fed to cows, but evidence is mounting that H5N1 is now spreading inside herds. Such mammal-to-mammal transmission puts H5N1 one step closer to being able to spread among humans. Genetic sequencing of the virus in the Texas patient revealed one mutation that improves its ability to replicate inside mammals, but there's no evidence yet that the variant has adapted to spread efficiently among humans. Still, the Texas case should serve as a warning, says virologist Angie Rasmussen. The less human or cow transmission we have, the fewer of these mutations the virus can acquire. The two U.S. cases to date have been mild. A prison inmate who caught the virus while killing infected birds at a Colorado farm in 2022 suffered only fatigue. The Texas patient's sole symptom was pink eye. To catch the disease, a person typically needs to inhale massive amounts of the virus, which might happen while sweeping up infected fecal matter, for example. That's because the protein the current strain uses to penetrate cells does not attach easily to the receptors in the human nose, throat, or upper lungs, which would allow it to lock in and start pumping out copies of itself. Still, infections do happen, and once the virus reaches the lower lungs, it can be fatal. Some 900 people worldwide have been diagnosed with H5N1 over the past two decades, and about half have died. And the sheer scale of this outbreak gives the virus plenty of opportunities to evolve and potentially to gain the ability to breach defenses in the human upper respiratory tract or become more transmittable through coughs or sneezes. Some mammalian species may be suitable genetic mixing vessels to create a human pandemic strain, said epidemiologist Raina McIntyre. But even without human-to-human spread, the virus has hammered the poultry industry and added to consumers' pain at the grocery store. The Agriculture Department has spent more than $1 billion so far on compensating farmers for culled flocks and on measures to suppress the disease. Agricultural economists estimate the industry has suffered another $1 billion in damages from lost sales. Infections and culls took out nearly a third of egg-laying hens in 2022. That, in turn, caused prices to soar for consumers. A dozen eggs sold for a nationwide average of $4.82 in early 2023, more than double the price a year earlier. Egg prices have since dipped sharply, but this month the nation's largest egg producer, Cal-Maine Foods, announced it had to cull another 2 million hens at its Parmer County, Texas plant following a bird flu outbreak. There are several licensed bird flu vaccines, and countries including China, Egypt, and Mexico now inoculate poultry. But the U.S. Department of Agriculture is hesitant to follow suit. The vaccine formulas are chasing a constantly evolving threat, and none is tailored precisely to the current strain. Vaccination could also hurt exports. Many countries refuse to accept meat from inoculated chickens, arguing the immune response to vaccination is so similar to an infection that it's impossible to tell a safe bird from a virus carrier. Some experts say the only fix is to rethink poultry farming and to stop cramming tens of thousands of birds, engineered to be as homogeneous and teeteringly plump as possible, into metal barns. Such a densely packed space is the perfect environment for a virus to spread and evolve quickly. It's a man-made problem, said pathologist Thies Kieken of Erasmus University in the Netherlands. We're knowingly risking our own lives by allowing this kind of system to continue as it is. It must be true. I read it in the tabloids. The owner of a Kansas bakery is warning customers that they may find a diamond in one of her cookies. Dawn Sis Monroe of Sis Sweets Cookies and Cafe in Leavenworth announced on social media that she recently lost the center diamond from her wedding ring and suspects it came off while she hand-mixed a batch of cookie dough. I didn't want anyone to break a tooth, she said, adding that if a customer returned the stone, I would be forever in your debt. Bay Area residents were shocked to see a two-story house floating across San Francisco Bay. It turned out to be a houseboat that had been evicted from a marina in Redwood City and was moving to a new home in Sausalito. Pulled by a towboat, the wood-shingled home took several days to make the trip. You have to have the tide right, said Sausalito resident Phil Hott. You don't want it to drag you out to the Golden Gate Bridge. A 22-year-old pro soccer player from Peru is drawing notice for his unusual name, Osama Bin Laden Jimenez Lopez. Lopez, whose second name is pronounced with a B sound in Spanish, was born a year after Osama Bin Laden attacked the Twin Towers. The name was in the news and my father liked it, he said. He has a brother named Saddam Hussein. Another sibling would have been named George Bush, but it was a girl. He said he'd thought about changing his name, but had made peace with it. Still, he said, he plans to name his own son something conventional like Santiago. Tradwives, a retro lifestyle, goes viral. The 1950s are back, said Elise Morales in Jezebel, or at least they are on social media. Instagram and TikTok feeds are now clogged with tradwives, perfectly coiffed young influencers in hand-embroidered aprons who have accumulated millions of followers by gushing about the joys of keeping house and traditional womanhood. The movement's first domestic icon, Alina Kate Pettit, claims she was stifled by modern feminism and her job in marketing. But her marital woes vanished when she gave it all up to become a housewife, which included submitting to her husband as head of the house. A legion of tradwives soon appeared online. There's desexed Marilyn Monroe clone Esty Williams, who posts videos with titles like Biblically Submissive Wives. Former dancer Hannah Nealman, who entered a beauty pageant 2 weeks after giving birth to her eighth child, and Nara Smith, who makes cooked-from-scratch versions of Cheez-Its and Cookie Crisp cereal. It's an intoxicating hit of post-war perfectionism, enough to make viewers forget that the dream they're selling is actually a nightmare. Women are embracing nostalgia because the modern world has failed them, said Caroline Burke in katiecurric.com. They're routinely expected to have a full-time job and to handle most of the housework and childcare. With few companies offering generous parental leave, it's no surprise some Gen Z girls find the tradwife movement to be appealing. Amid the giddy promotion of this anti-feminist lifestyle, the possibility of an ugly breakup tends to go unmentioned, said divorce coach Amy Polacco in Ms. I worked with one former trad wife whose ex-husband expected her to meet his sexual needs on demand while he controlled all the money. When the marriage failed due to his multiple affairs, he wound up in a comfortable home and she, with no alimony and few job prospects, lives in a trailer. Longing for a simpler way of life is totally legit, said Emma Beddington in The Guardian. Watching a young woman meditatively pickling beets in a shaft of sunlight can make old-fashioned drudgery look like the most fun ever, until the usually white influencer starts ranting about the evils of feminism. But a pared-back, purposeful life doesn't have to be trad. It can be diverse and radical, like the lesbian sheep farming couple from Iceland I found on Instagram, or the Black Atlanta radio personality whose pandemic-era experiment in hen-keeping turned into a small farm. I'd rather be soothed by the hope of future change, not the false allure of reactionary retro fantasy business. Basketball superstar Caitlin Clark will be paid about $76,500 in salary during her first year as a WNBA player. That pales in comparison with the roughly $3 million she'll receive over the next year in advertising deals, according to data tracker On3, Bloomberg. Credit cards. Will a war on swipe fees kill rewards? Banks and credit card companies are desperate to head off an effort in Congress to slash the lucrative swipe fees they get from every credit card purchase, said Paul J. Davies in Bloomberg. That's why last month they cut a deal with some retailers to end a 20-year-old lawsuit over the fees. The deal saves merchants $30 billion over 5 years, which should be a win for consumers. But it reduces swipe fees, more formally known as interchange fees, which average 2.26% by a tiny 0.07%. Yes, you heard that right. Even that is guaranteed for just 5 years. The settlement does let stores charge customers far more for high-end reward cards, which come with even higher merchant fees. But merchants also don't like being made to look like the bad guy if they are to begin charging some customers with fancier credit cards more. So they've thrown full support behind a bipartisan bill that would permanently cap fees and effectively break up the Visa MasterCard network duopoly. Last year alone, merchants paid a record $172 billion in processing fees to accept $11.2 trillion in card payments, said Paul Kwan Yuk in Financial Times. The lion's share of those fees goes to the banks that issue the credit cards. A $100 transaction generates about $2.50 in fees, of which about $1.80 goes to the bank. It's not clear who will pay the small cut in fees demanded by the settlement, but for Visa, MasterCard, and their bank partners, their high-margin business model remains intact. Still, this deal doesn't bode well for credit card rewards, said Hannah Aaron Lang in MarketWatch. Card issuers argue that revenue earned from interchange fees helps them fund rewards programs like airline miles, cashback, or dining points. The settlement chips away at that revenue. but it's not nearly as catastrophic for high-end rewards as a proposed credit card competition act, which would let merchants steer payments around the Visa and MasterCard networks. Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat, Illinois, a co-sponsor of the bill, dismissed the latest swipe fee deal as a small concession negotiated by a few lawyers behind closed doors. The problem with the bill is that it will likely backfire on the very consumers that lawmakers are aiming to help, said Eric Boehm in Reason. We've seen this play out before. The Dodd-Frank Act in 2010 capped fees on debit card payments, and banks largely did away with debit reward programs and other consumer benefits such as free checking. Congress is now leading a crusade to repeat the same mistake. Obituary. The celebrity athlete who was acquitted in the trial of the century. No American celebrity has ever fallen from grace as fast and hard as O.J. Simpson. The Juice was launched to stardom in the 1970s through his astounding speed and grace as a running back, first at the University of Southern California and then over a record-setting 11-year NFL career. He leveraged his football success, charisma, and good looks into roles as an actor, TV commentator, and pitchman, most notably in a series of Hertz ads where he sprinted through airports. All that changed in June 1994 when his ex-wife Nicole Brown Simpson and her friend Ronald Goldman were found brutally murdered outside her Los Angeles home. Extensive forensic evidence and a history of battering Nicole implicated O.J., but after an 8-month televised trial that riveted the nation, lead attorney Johnny Cochran's insistence that Simpson was framed by racist LAPD officers led to a stunning acquittal by a mostly black jury. Found liable for the deaths in a 1997 civil trial, Simpson forever denied culpability. With his death from cancer, the hope for true accountability has ended, said Goldman's father, Fred. This is Jude Costello, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.